I see noise, but I hear noise, but I don't really hear a voice. So you might want to wiggle the antenna or kick up the gain or something. I just wanted to add to Rich that although all the digital voice boats do have this internet protocol backbone, Yaesu's Fusion Digital Technology has their WireZX, and there's a third party called the YSF. DMR has their talk groups, and Brandmeister is a parallel configuration, and D-Star has their reflectors and a parallel third party called XLX gateways. There are similar for regular analog FM radio. There are people who listen to us occasionally from Australia via EchoLink, and if they wanted to talk, they could. And our own John down in Los Alamos is here thanks to IRLP technology, which is an internet protocol connecting analog FM repeaters. Any other questions or comments related to DMR or digital mode as long as we're down this road?
Roy, if somebody's contemplating it down the road, you could suggest to them what you suggested to me in terms of DMR versus the other modes.
Well, I suggested a whole bunch of things. I think one thing to just put your big toe in the water without any cost, and I've heard people talk about it recently, and is an application that's available on any Android phone. It's not been written for iPhones, unfortunately, for mysterious reasons. There's a gentleman out there that has this this program called Peanut. You can get it for PCs if you only have an iPhone, or as I said, if you have an Android, it's a free application. You send him proof of your license, and he gives you access to a gateway to a gateway to a gateway, and you can actually access a small group of reflectors and gateways and such. I think the list, the worldwide list is probably 100, but the ones that speak before you start to buy handy talkies and hotspots and such. Okay, once again, any other questions related to this particular subject?
Another question.
Yes, would you like the ID?
Why not? This is W2HL. Is it possible, I'm not that familiar with, I haven't submersed myself in the digital world yet. One question that I have I can think of right now is, can you, like for instance on Simplex, can you say just on any particular digital, say DMR, can you transmit using DMR on digital Simplex? In other words, digital to digital without the use of the internet or repeaters. Roy, over.
Yes, Howie, you can. Matter of fact, as I mentioned earlier, when DMR first came out, it came out in stages called tiers. Tier 1 was a simplex point-to-point protocol. It was only after they designed Tier 2 that you were able to deal with repeaters and linked talk groups and other things that most hams really enjoy. But you can certainly operate Simplex. Pretty much all of the digital technologies, D-Star, DMR, and Fusion, allow simple point-to-point Simplex operation between two people with the same technology.
Okay, I was curious about that. I thought it was only like I thought that was possible. I thought maybe it was only through repeaters and things like that. Yeah, very good. I got to try it out. I hear the DMR doesn't have such great audio, and I hear Fusion had better audio, and then I heard Keystar had better, but I don't know. Okay, Roy, thank you very much for everything, and hope all is well. W2HO.
Yes, all is well here. I hope that all is well with you and Ina. Different people like different qualities. Unfortunately, because of the nature of digital voice, they are not perfect analog representations of people's voices. Because in changing the analog to the FCC, the way that the technology gets around this is to put it through a voice encoder decoder that actually can detect phoneme and press data about the phonemes themselves. Then on the other end, they're translated from the bitstream back to audio phonemes and massaged into a recognizable voice. And some people like it, some people don't like it. Some people can't tell the artifact at all, apparently. And also, when the data packets are lost, unlike analog, in which you just hear more and more background noise, and it's more and more difficult to understand and make intelligible the transmission, once a certain amount of packet loss occurs, beyond the error correction that are designed into the protocol, the splatter is unworldly. Some people call it R2D2ing, especially D-star reflector groups commonly call it that. The voice encoder decoder technology is a little older on D-star. Some people don't like it because of that. DMR and Fusion uses a somewhat newer voice encoder decoder, so some people like that. But, you know, there are people who live and die by one of these digital modes, and there are others who like them all, and then there are others who hate them all. So, you know, try it out, you know, listen to someone else's radio to save yourself a buck or two, and if it appeals to you, then so be it. If not, then you've learned a lesson.
Can I make a comment on this, Roy? M2EO.
W2HL, back to you.
Okay, Howie. Unfortunately, as per the...
No, nothing personal. But I will still lie, Mark. Anyway, I'm clear. I do have some good information. But to act with it. M2EO gone.
Okay, once again, nothing personal. Anyway, anyone with any further questions on this particular subject, please feel free to hit that push to talk button. Okay, I'll ask if Joe from earlier tonight, he said that he had a question. I've heard him on the TechNet before, and sometimes he has to go someplace else. I understand that entirely, but in case Joe is back from wherever he was and wants to ask that
question. K2QR.
Yes, Fred.
This is a somewhat simple question, but I was in my attic this evening, or earlier today, and I was rummaging around, looking for one thing, and of course picked up something else. And it was some kids' toys, and the first thing I said was, "Oh, this is a great toy. I hope they took the batteries out of it." And I opened it up, and of course the batteries had, what batteries do, they leaked. And, I got a brush, and I got a nail file, and I got some alcohol, but what's the best way to get all that gook off of the terminals and whatever else is, you know, onto the the contacts? Okay, back to that K2QR.
Okay, Freddie, it's probably not something I would call a simple question because I haven't heard the ultimate answer yet. As you know, most battery technologies these days use alkaline. Batteries. Obviously, that's because the electrolyte is an alkaline material as a contact. but actually partially corroding the contacts. And once corroded, you know, short of plating, I don't know how you bring that part back. I have heard all kinds of things that you've used, isopropyl alcohol, a file to just kind of scrape off the crud and the corrosion and the oxide of the metal. But beyond that point, I am unfamiliar with any kind of magical solution. I'm sort of curious whether anyone out there who has delved into the field better than I has come out with better recommendations for how to reversing the effect of a exploding, leaking alkaline battery in a consumer product. So if you have any good suggestions in addition to the ones that I mentioned, please feel free to hit that push to talk button.
WB2KWC, can I step on a foot switch?
Okay, unfortunately I don't have his ID again.
Niggers.
What did you want to add, Ed?
Ken, I heard you. Let's see. One thought. They used to make something called television tuner cleaner, which I think is chemically the same thing as automotive, quote, carburetor cleaner, brake cleaner, or guns, crud cutter. This is a family of hydrocarbon solvents. That if I remember right, I once tried it and I was fairly pleased with the results. And it was 10 KWC trying to get in there.
Snickers. Okay, Ed. I have used contact cleaner before. I use it for kind of switches that don't want to work anymore. Usually objects that have developed oxide films over them. I've never really tried it, as far as I can recall, for severely corroded contacts from leaky batteries. Have you tried this specifically for those situations, and did you find that it rejuvenated it at all or made it more tolerable?
I can't give you a hard answer, but I have a vague recollection of doing it and being pleased.
Okay, so that's another idea for Fred, using contact cleaner. I think it's very good to have a can of that around just for the heck of it, because inevitably everyone has a device where the switches aren't quite working. It doesn't work well for things like remote controls, where it uses one of those contact PCs and some carbon coated rubber, because what happens with them is a little different. The rubber kind of breaks down and the carbon kind of falls out of the contact and such. But for regular electrical switches, at the very least, it's a very nice product to have. And so as long as you have a can of it and nothing better to do, you might want to squirt it at the device that has the leaking alkaline batteries. Couldn't hurt.
N2YC.
Yes. Once again, this is AC2GS, and I believe Ken wanted mentioned something about a foot pedal. Unfortunately, he doubled with me, so I only heard the tail end of it. I'm sorry that I doubled with you. Are you out there?
Yes, I am. You said to push the push-to-talk switch, and I'm using a foot pedal. Anyhow, my comment had nothing to do with that remark. I believe you said something about a nail file, and I'm always reluctant to use something like a nail file on contact, just in case they have some kind of a coating on them for a better conductivity.
N2YC.
N2YC recognized. We'll get to you in 1 second. I guess it's possible for better durability, what have you. I think, though, once you've got a leaky alkaline battery, the surface layer of those things tend to have already been undermined. So I think the most important thing tends to be removing the corrosive material, even if it's at the price of a more delicate external plating. But, you know, you could try it in degrees. You could first try solvents, and then you can try the contact cleaner, and as a last resort, an abrasive. But, you know, ultimately, if my choice is keeping the corrosion encrusted in it and using an abrasion, I would probably go for the abrasion. N2YC, you have a comment.
Yeah, thank you. Name here is John, and good evening to the net. I've had success with battery leakage on circuit boards, printed circuit boards with baking soda, water, and a Q-tip. I don't know the extent of the corrosion on this piece of electronic, but household ingredients, baking soda, water, Q-tip, and it worked very well for me. N2YC.
Another idea.
Yes, Ed.
Auto parts stores sell a product for getting a crud off of car battery terminals. I think there's a chance that might be useful. KBDX.
Yes, DXT.
Yes, KB2DX. So yes, I've had a lot of success with contact cleaners. I stay away from anything that really is a solvent. And I've also used a baking soda and water solution that works really well. As far as a toy is concerned, as opposed to, let's say, a handheld radio, I most certainly would try the baking soda solution. And as far as any, I don't know, corroded contacts or terminals, you might want to try tinning it with some solder to, you know, at least give it a better surface. KB2DXC.
Okay, thanks a lot for that. Although, if it's been there for a long, long time, it's just kind of eaten away at the electrodes. You know, usually by some of the acid. A person sitting there reading a flow chart who would ultimately say that they're not responding. What do you puzzle I got?
KD2MVB with a guess.
Okay, Bob, what's your guess?
What? Morse code is kind of a language, so I'm just going to make a wild guess that this is a general guess, like some kind of language thing, maybe English or maybe a foreign language, something like that. That's my guess. Back to you, Roy.
WB2KWC.
Ken recognized. Bob, it makes a lot of sense what you say. That isn't what he thought, but it certainly is consistent, makes sense. Ken, what's your ideas?
Could he?
Exactly, I think, the proper way of playing this, but so be it. Yes, he was a professor that taught sculpture and painting. And I thought that was somewhat fascinating because automatically that wouldn't come to mind unless you knew the history of Samuel Morse, and, you know, back in the 1800s, life was not simple. You didn't go to school for one thing and only, you know, work on that one thing. You tried to be about as much a Renaissance man as you could. So, yeah, Samuel Morse was a professor of sculpture and painting at New York University, and the plaque is still there today. If you ever have an opportunity to be around Washington Square, right across the street from the park itself, is the building with that lovely brass or bronze plaque commemorating that Samuel Morse had a had an office in that building.
W2HO.
Yes, Howard.
Yeah, he was some painter. I believe that he also was commissioned, I'm not 100% sure, he was commissioned to paint portraits for some presidents, I believe. Quite prolific painter. I just wanted to mention that he is, if anyone wants to see his grave, he's buried at Greenwood Cemetery in Brooklyn. Back to you.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much, Howard. I didn't know that he was buried there, but it makes sense since he worked in Manhattan, so that he would be buried in Greenwood. I thought it would be interesting, and I hope people kind of enjoyed that, and since it seemed to go over reasonably well. Here's another little puzzle for everyone. We don't do politics, but we can do a degree of trivia related to politics, and so my next question is that there was a presidential candidate this season who might have come and might have gone, who had at one time an amateur radio license. Does anyone want to hazard a guess which of the presidential candidates for 2020 had an amateur radio license at one time?
W2HO.
Yes, Howie.
Michael Bloomberg.
Okay, very good. You are absolutely positively correct. Michael Bloomberg, some people don't know, but he is a trained engineer. Matter of fact, his first fortune comes from the design and production and sales of devices that I believe are still being used among the stock exchange companies, Bloomberg machines, before he took some of that money and went into the communications industry. But he was an engineer and a tinkerer, and when he was a kid, he had an amateur radio license. I don't think it survived his college life, unfortunately. We did have a ham running for president. The last ham, and I probably have it wrong because there were probably other people who ran that I'm not even aware of course, was back in 1964. I'm blanking on the guy. Barry Goldwater. Yeah, Barry Goldwater was an amateur radio operator, and I think he still had his license at the time. So we almost had a ham in the White House. The closest thing to a ham in the White House, to my knowledge, was Woodrow Wilson's son was an amateur radio operator. He was actually a big guy at ARRL for a while. But he wasn't president. He was just the first son, if you will. I am so incredibly bad with direction that even with a compass, I would probably get lost. But if you recall, the New York University is only really on one side of the park, so it's the block that opposes the edge of the park, the central portion. There's a building in the middle, straight across opposite, that you can see the park, and then there are throughways where you can walk down and row of NYU buildings on the side. So it's the one that just abuts the outside of Washington Square Park. I unfortunately don't remember north, south, east, or west.
On the side where the arch is, or the opposite side?
Well, the arch is kind of in the middle. This would be to the side of the arch, and you can't say the right or the left because they're kind of symmetrical. So at a right angle to the opening of the arch is a row of New York University begins at that point and keeps going on for a couple of blocks.
Yeah, Washington Mews, I believe, is what you're talking about. They actually have property around the whole park. I used to work there, and I would do catering around all those buildings. So, all right, I just wanted to know. I'll have to look for it. Thank you.
WB2EAV.
Yes, Ed.
You mentioned Barry Goldwater. unlike a lot of other fairly famous figures who had ham licenses, Barry Goldwater was K7UGA, and he was very, very active on 20 meters as a U.S. senator. And while I never worked him, I knew a lot of people who did.
Yes, I heard that about him. He was an actual active ham. He didn't just have a license, or he didn't have a history when he was a kid that he had a license for a couple of years and didn't know what happened to it. And I have seen, at least in more than a few QST magazines, copies of his QSL cards, because especially back in the late 60s, early 70s, Barry Goldwater was very active operating his station, and people were very proud to have a QSL card from him. So I can, in my mind's eye, I can recall the QST reproducing images of that QSL card that he would send out to people. And, you know, I was told that, you know, in the fine spirit of amateur radio, he was a delightful person on the air and more than happy to send out QSL cards. And it's sort of a shame that we don't have people quite that famous. You know, everyone kind of tries to crib a list of famous amateur radio operators, and for the most part, they're people who've shuffled off this mortal coil. I mean, people are still using Walter Cronkite on that list, and unfortunately, he's been a silent key for a while now.
WB2KWC.
Yes, Cam.
Okay, some of the things I remember about Barry Goldwater is not only was he active, but apparently he had quite an extensive station in Arizona and used it as one end of phone patches for I forget, it was Army Mars or Air Force Mars or whatever it was. And he also had a call in Washington. K3UIG was also his call.
News to me. Again, probably, well, I don't know exactly why, but just about everything that I read in QST back in the old days alluded to his Arizona shack, but that's interesting to know. I could easily see Barry Goldwater setting up phone patches for the troops elsewhere. He was, very proud of the military, and I could see him doing that easily.
I'm wondering if the K3UIG, is it possible that they had separate station licenses as opposed to personal licenses, and this was simply a station license in D.C.?
Well, that presupposes an interesting question to me. I don't know if you could answer it or anyone can answer it. We now live in completely different times where we could take our area number any place and it almost means nothing. It just means where you either wanted it to be for a vanity call sign or where you were first licensed. In the old days, my understanding was that you could operate mobile outside of your area number, but you had to designate that it was a mobile. And if you were planning to leave that area number consistently, if it wasn't a temporary thing, you had to file with the FCC for a new call sign with that area number. So I'm wondering if someone who has some friends in the FCC, anyway, wanted to have a correct area number for Washington, D.C., but keep his area number for when he was in Arizona, whether he could arrange something along those lines. Okay, I guess no one knows that question. That's an interesting thing to look up, because I'm sure most of you people remember those days where if you moved from one area to another area, you lost your beloved call sign. Nowadays, the FCC doesn't really care, so you can go any place you want as long as it's the United States the territory or state, and keep whatever state region number that's inside your call sign. But that's, I think, hopefully that's an interesting little bit of a puzzle. And I will cap it with a third, more involved puzzle that's more of a technical nature than a trivial nature. Everyone, hopefully, knows about the layers of the ionosphere. Matter of fact, you can't really pass an FCC license these days without knowing something about the D and the E and the F layer. So I will throw it out to the general audience and people who know better than I probably. What happened to A, B, and C? Do they exist? Did they exist? Or why is there just a D, E, and F ionospheric layer defined? So if anyone has any ideas or knows specifically or wants to furiously Google that information, please give me your call sign.
Black Lives Matter.
I have a thought, WB2AV.
Okay, Ed.
I don't know this. This is an educated guess. A, B, and C refer to other labels.
I'm sorry, Ed. Someone stepped over you. Would you like to try and repeat it?
I believe the troposphere that we live in could possibly be the A layer. Then I forget what the middle range is. It's the B and the C, and then the ionosphere starts with D. I don't know that. That's just the hypothesis.
Okay, it's a good hypothesis, Ed. Does anyone else have any ideas on this subject? Please, give me your call sign.
W2NIG here, and Black Lives Matter.
KD2NVB with a guess.
Yes, Bob.
Yeah, just kind of expanding on what Ed said. I mean, the stratosphere is going to be one of them, probably. And troposphere, maybe troposphere, stratosphere, but then there's got to be a third one. I don't know. Maybe they split the stratosphere. I don't know there. But just sort of hinting at it. So the stratosphere is probably one of them, or maybe it's two of them. I don't know. My guess, back to that.
Okay, very good, Bob. Fun. Just exercise people's brains and consider the possibilities and see what we come up with. So, you know, don't feel any kind of embarrassment. I don't pick answers that questions that have simple, easy answers that every third guy knows. It's something to stretch our brains over. So, if you have any ideas or considerations that you'd like to share, please do give me a call sign.
DXC.
Yes, DXC.
Yeah, KAB2DXC. Just getting back to possibly ever having a president with a ham ticket in the White House, and if he really wanted to set up a station in the White House, do you think for security reasons they would let him?
That is a very good question. Theoretically, probably presidents can overrule everyone else. So ultimately, if he wanted it, they would find a way to give it to him. I don't exactly know how that would work. There are other options. It's possible that they would set up a remote operating system in a secure manner that's sealed off to the rest of the White House. So, you know, considering the almost ultimate power of the executive office and the unlimited purse of that institution, I would assume if someone really, really wanted one very hard, he would get something that came close, if not exactly that.
I would think, you know, when you think back when President Obama first went into office, and I think the story was he wanted to keep his iPhone or whatever smartphone he had.
But the conditions that Secret Service set up was that we got to strip it down of a lot of features, you know, like the camera, this, that, the other, where it almost turned out to be just a basic phone. But, you know, I was also just thinking that, you know, now with a lot of remote station operating that's available now, that would most certainly have been an object. That I understand. And then I also would think the National Park Service might have an issue with, like, you know, having like 36 Yaggies or whatever else he wants to put on the roof on top of the White House might not go over too well. KV2DXV back to net.
Okay, I mean, ultimately it's sort of how much power you want to pull. If you want to pull, you know, if you want to go to the trouble of writing an executive order on the subject, to anyway. So I think it's how much you really want what you really want. I think if a president wants to use an insecure phone, the Secret Service can make a lot of noise and plead a lot and demand a lot, but when push comes to shove, if the president wants it, the president sort of gets it these days.
Michelle Obama had a Yagi in her pants.
That, you know, would be a pilot magnet to be able to hear a call sign coming out of the White House. Okay, back to you.
And WS2N? Yes, Paul. Yeah, going back to a potential president, you could have had it in there. He was thinking about running. What governor from New York had a license? I'm sure these guys are going to get this quick, but what governor had a ham license back to Roy?
Pataki.
I told you. It was George Pataki. I knew that. I knew that was going to happen. Back to you, Roy. Okay, for whatever reason, though, I do not have a memory of his actual call sign. I knew that he was an amateur radio operator. But for the life of me, as opposed to Goldwater, who had a very famous call sign, I don't know. Do you offhand know Pataki's call sign?
No, at one time. I guess I can find it. But I guess not. As far as the radio in the White House, they could always put one in, like, Camp David or something, you know. A little bit more remote. And, well, look at the guy that's in the office now. Look, he's using a cell phone. He uses his own cell phone. They tried to take that away from him.
Yeah, I mean, constitutionally, the President of the United States is in an interesting situation, being the executor of one of the three branches of the entire government. He can give himself security clearance. He can give anyone security clearance. He could downgrade any information security clearance down to unclassified. It's close to it's significantly close to ultimate governmental power. So again, if you're strong-willed enough and you don't care about annoying bureaucrats, you can kind of do anything that you want. Although I could easily see where they would set up a remote station at Camp David and then just, you know, have an internet-based communication. Remote radio transmissions are very popular these days. You know, everyone, you know, with a license can sign up to some commercial services usually it's per minute or per hour. You can be hooked up and operate an enormous semi-professional shack through an internet protocol connection, and many different radios that are capable of remote control. LCAP has them. Flex Radio has them as well. But just in case anyone actually seems to care, I just want to try one last time to see if I could get someone to come up with a different solution to the question of that the ionospheric layers that we all talk about are D, E, and F, and I just want to know if anyone has any idea whatever happened to A, B, and C.
WB2KWC with a crackpot idea.
Okay, Ken, crack away.
Okay, I'm wondering, I'm thinking negative. Do the layers underground have designations, and could they be A, B, and C for so many feet underground?
Okay, that's an interesting thing to posit. You have to realize that these are ionospheric layers. And capable of a certain degree of becoming ionized. So below the surface of the Earth, you would not probably expect any ionic gases to exist. So it would probably just kind of by definition have to begin some point above the surface of the solid Earth.
Okay, I didn't know what they were for, but if we think in more general terms, let's say communications.
Okay, unfortunately, Ken, someone doubled with you, so the last 10-15 seconds didn't come across.
Okay, I was just thinking of communications layers and thinking as you go negative, I know they have to account for those things in VLF communications with, let's say, submarines and things like that.
Okay, yeah, that is a point. I don't think there's any propagation conditions, though at those levels that can be addressed by ionization that produces absorption, reflection, refraction, transmission, and dispersion. It's kind of water is the media for most of those very low frequencies below the water, air water level.
Okay, very possible or probable. I was just throwing out, I guess, different ideas.
Okay, Ken, and I appreciate it. That's what I'm going for. Not necessarily the right idea, but a good theory is based on kind of common sense and logical approach, because science is logical. Unfortunately, there's a lot of logical answers that aren't the actual answer. In the olden days of natural philosophy, which is sort of what used to be what physics was called, in Aristotle's time, they basically just kind of sat on rocks and they thought of interesting, reasonable solutions to puzzles and problems without bothering to actually do any experimental evidence because they were aristocrats. They didn't do the work. They just thought a lot. And so you had a lot of very, very bright ideas, clever thoughts, clever concepts. The fundamental basis for all matter was earth, wind, fire, water, and soil or something. And everything was just a combination of those fundamental groups. And they had other things. But nevertheless, anyone else with any thoughts or ideas on the subject before I give it away?
W2HL.
Yes, Howard.
I'm thinking that there is an A, B, and C layer, the ionosphere, but the radio signals are just propagating in the D, E, and F1 layer. The frequencies that we use probably not propagated in the A, B, and C layer. That's just a guess.
Okay, it's a good guess, and part of that guess is actually true. When I explain the details to you, you'll understand why some of it is true. And I appreciate you giving me this suggestion. Once again, I know I might be sound like I'm kicking a dead horse, but I would like to just, I'm curious to see if anyone else would like to play tonight. Again, participation on puzzles will probably lead to more puzzles in the future. So if anyone else has any ideas on this particular question, please give me a call.
NY2H.
Yes, Lou.
Maybe the D layer is in the daytime, so maybe they named that D, and because they had a D already, they just kept adding on to an E and F.
That's a very good idea, and it also is very close to the actual answer. It's not quite the answer, but it's incredibly close to the answer.
Maybe they had an E layer for electricity, and then they discovered the others, and they had to label them accordingly.
Give that man the prize, and you laughed when you said that. The first ionospheric layer that was ever detected, Marconi, when he was working on the transcontinental communications, coined the phrase for the electronic layer, the E layer of the ionosphere. So the very beginning didn't start alphabetically. It just arbitrarily started with E because it was the first letter for what Marconi wanted to call the layer that he was interested in. It was only after that they discerned that there were other ionospheric layers at different levels of the atmosphere that had somewhat different qualities. They found the so-called D layer, and then they found the F layer, and then they found that under high energy, it behaves as though it's two separate layers, so we have the F1 and the F2. And matter of fact, there is a C layer. It doesn't affect radio propagation, so amateur radio operators aren't taught it, and most people don't pay attention to it. But C layers are energized by cosmic rays, whereas the D, E, and F1 and 2 are more solar winds and ultraviolet energy that activates it. So that's why there's only a D, E, and F layer, because we don't care about the C layer, as someone mentioned, because it's not really involved in propagation, and there was never an A or B because no one found an ionospheric layer lower than the C layer that did anything useful. So no one coined that phrase. So that's why there's a D, E, and F1, F2 layer and nothing else. So I thank everyone for playing, and I thank especially Lou for coming up with the idea, although I think he thought it was a funny idea when he said it.
Hey, C2PO.
Yes.
Hey, Roy. It's Jeff Alpha Charlie 2 Papa Lima. Yeah, I was looking on KB6NU's website when you said we were allowed to furiously Google. And he says that Appleton named it originally the E layer. Is that correct, or am I missing it?
Well, I read someplace that it was related to Marconi and his invention, his attempts at transcontinental communication. Appleton might have been the guy who actually wrote the paper up, because Marconi never struck me as a guy who particularly liked to publish things. He was more of an entrepreneur.
That's unfortunate. Could you imagine the things he would have written? AC2PL, thank you, Roy.
You're welcome. Well, it would be in Italian, so it would require a translation, but some of these guys back in the good old days would have been endlessly amusing to listen to. You know, he was kind of very much like, to a degree, Nikola Tesla. These were very strong promoters of their technology. Nowadays, for the most part, people who design and build technology are rather quiet guys who work for loud guys who are the management or the marketing department. So, unfortunately, neither the twain shall meet these days, with the exception of entrepreneurs like good old Elon Musk, and Paul will be talking about him later tonight. Yeah, but he's not an inventor either. He's a money man. He knows how to run businesses, and he supports technologies by you know, giving them the money and trying to make a profit from it. So, you know, the scientist slash entrepreneur slash promoter is kind of an interesting thing that the early 20th century had that we don't seem to have any examples of, at least that I can think of offhand. Okay, so I hope people enjoyed these puzzles, and you know, maybe if I can think of some more, we'll bring them back in the future. I have other questions. They're not amateur radio related, but maybe we'll bring that back as well. It depends upon participation. If you guys want to play the puzzle with me, I'm more than happy to play one side of it to the other. So that in mind. Any other technical questions? If you have any questions in about 9 minutes, we're going to turn it over to Paul. But before that, if you have any technical questions that came up in your head and you want to ask them, please feel free. Okay, very well. Everyone's technicaled out. Once again, as I often offer people, sometimes everyone's in the mood to find out stuff, and sometimes they're tired of listening to it, so I understand both the ranges. If anyone would like to ask any questions related to the present coronavirus, as Dick used to mention, I am an actual physician. That's my field of training, so I've had close to 40 years of practice in internal medicine. So, you know, if anyone has any questions related to the coronavirus or anything associated with it, and you want to ask, this is as good a time as any. So if you have a question, please give us your call sign and your name.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Over the months, I've heard people, well, news reports say that, well, it could weaken, the virus itself could weaken over time. You know, scientifically, that doesn't sound possible. You know, it's a thing. It's got a shape. It's going to get into your lung, and it's going to do damage no matter what. I mean, what do they mean by weaken? I mean, you know, in the future, it's not going to be as effective. It's not going to be as destructive to each person. It doesn't sound right to me. Or is this a way of just saying that, well, maybe it's going to get better, you know, a miracle, you know? I'm just wondering if it's possible to have a virus weaken and not be as strong the next year or the year after and the year after, where it becomes like the flu. Back to you.
Well, that's a good question, Paul. Matter of fact, you have to understand that most living things will mutate over time. Unfortunately, this is one of the things that leads so very often to malignancy. But in going from generation to generation, there are failures in copying the genetic code. SARS-CoV-2 is a RNA virus. It's transmitted rather than DNA molecules that human beings, mammals, and many organisms use. It's not uncommon for viruses to use ribonucleic acids, RNA. And the copying is not a perfect copy, and so there are errors in the reproduction of the genetic code. And so far as I'm aware, there's over 6,822 different variations on the SARS-CoV-2 virus genome. Most of these are of immaterial. There's a lot of redundancy and such, so that you can get away with as many as 6,822 without it becoming non-viable. So what they're suggesting is that this genetic drift that happens to most viruses, if not all, influenza changes every season. That's why, unfortunately, our immune system is incapable of recognizing it from season to season because of that genetic drift. And so we need a seasonal vaccine for influenza. They're suggesting that there will be some kind of drift going on with the virus in such a way as that it will be less dangerous. Let me drop for a second. Now, unfortunately, it's just as possible that a mutation will occur to make it more deadly. And there's a possibility of a mutation where its infective nature is, it becomes more infectious than it presently is. Now, there recently was a story that I was going to tell tonight about mutations of the SARS-CoV-2 virus. According to their research, it doesn't demonstrate that the mutations are producing any more virulent, more easily infected and spreading viruses. But all these things are possible. If you have a crystal ball, you can definitively say what happens across time. Will it get worse? Will it get better? Will it stay the same? Will it change so much that the vaccine, that hundreds of different vaccines being tried today, will not be effective? And unfortunately, my answer and most believable positions in medical researchers will tell you is we don't know. We're hoping for the best. We're doing whatever we can to kind of fix things. But there is a variable nature to life and viruses especially.
WB2KWC.
Yes, Cam.
Okay, I was wondering, considering the nature of the immune system, does the new virus have to be any weaker or stronger by itself, or just the fact that it's different, our immune system won't recognize the pattern to fight?
Well, it can be either or. The present 6,000 plus mutations that we have for the SARS-CoV-2 presently all pretty much produce the same immune response and the same ability to fight it. Thankfully, they're all preliminary. The antibody tests and unfortunately antibody tests, but also the vaccines. Not really to have any firm knowledge of whether there are various strains that are less, that are more resistant to the antibodies produced by the vaccine, but it is within reason possible to assume that the genetic drift will not be wide enough to cause a different presentation of surface proteins and RNA patterns that these vaccines promote antibodies for. But, you know, there's, like I said, 100 different vaccines in the experimental phase. And one of the things that I'm sure they're going to be testing for is the immune response to different variations, not all 6,000 mutations, but some of them. So it could be one or the other. You can have it be more infectious and still be able to be treated with antibodies because they might express the same protein that the antibodies are keyed for, or it could be different.
Hey, Roy, WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
How do the researchers know there's 6,822 different types of SARS? I mean, are they putting this from an electron microscope and saying, okay, this looks a little different, we're going to call this number one and number two? How do they know this? And, you know, can the number keep going up?
My guess is yes, unfortunately, or fortunately, I don't know which, the number will go up. And the reason is partially goes back to the Human Genome Project. You know, once upon a time, we...